All right, we're on.
All right. Welcome, 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 everybody. Listen, all I can say is buckle up because we're going to cover so much material, Ellen and I, in 1 hour, that you just might get the blind staggers. So here's what we suggest you do. Take notes. We're going to cover too much material for you to remember. You're going to think you can remember this by tomorrow. Ain't going to happen. So please make this worth your time investment by taking some good notes on this. So anyway, by the way, who in the heck are we to deliver so much practice-changing material in 1 hour? So let me introduce, because some of you people are not familiar with both of us. Some of you are. So let me introduce my partner, my wife, Ellen. She co-founded the Couples Institute with her husband, that would be me, in 1984. She's also co-authored 2 books, one for the public called Tell Me No Lies. It's about being honest with compassion in a marriage, and co-authored a book for therapists called In Quest of the Mythical Mate, still going strong after its 17th printing. She's been featured in almost all the major media, including Good Morning America, Cosmo, Oprah, CBS Morning Show, et cetera, a presenter at major conferences. But here's the one that I think she is the most proud of. She's been a pioneer in developing online training for couples therapists around the world.
Hey, thank you, Pete. And it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Peter Pearson, my husband, and also co-founder of the Couples Institute and co-creator of the developmental model of couples therapy. And I think 2 very special things about Pete. He has seen between 20 and 30 couples a week now for almost 25 years. And I think he's probably the person, at least in the United States, as far as I know, who has actually seen the most couples in the trenches of anyone I've ever talked to. So I think he's learned a thing or two doing that. He's also run over 70 intensive workshops for couples.
Weekend workshops.
And what is special about Pete is that he's always pushing to do it better and to find new and different ways that really impact and make significant change in couples' lives.
2 reasons why people change. One is inspiration, the other is desperation. A lot of my changes have come out of desperation. In working with so many different couples in so many situations that just to survive and find better and better ways of helping them work harder than I do creates more and more interventions, ideas, concept, principles, insights, and interventions. And that's what we're going to share a lot today, which is the heart of so much change of couples, which is the complexity of motivation. And so let me just give you a quick headline of what we're covering today so that you get a bird's eye perspective. We're going to talk about the complexity of motivation using an example from your own life when we said think about a goal that really stretches you. We're going to talk about the motivation formula, the parts of a motivation concept that we're going to apply to 2 clinical cases so that you can use this approach to motivation to break it down both for your couples and for your individual clients. Then we'll give you a quick summary of our survey of hundreds of therapists on how they try to bring back the dead to life with their favorite motivation interventions. Then we're going to talk about the confirmation bias.
The negative confirmation bias.
And especially the negative confirmation bias. And give you an exercise that will help couples break their rigid perspectives and help them loosen their grip on being a persecutor or a victim in their relationship. And then at the end of the call, we're going to talk about a handout to help you avoid that dreaded question from distressed couples, which is, are we getting anywhere? That question usually asked after they don't do the homework, they don't apply the feedback and insight that you give them. And this turned out to be a really great intervention, especially with one couple I saw recently after she said she couldn't even stand being in the same room with her husband. All right. So, and we're going to add some stuff on top of that, too, about the complexity of goals and da-da-da-da-da-da. So, man, we got a lot to cover. All right, so let's start first. We ask you to think of a goal that was important, something that would involve stretching yourself. In fact, it would stretch yourself so much that thinking about it might cause the sphincter muscles to tighten up or at least give you some tension in your stomach, your chest, or your neck. Okay, now, if you had thought of such a goal, or if you think of one right now, and you think about achieving that goal, what do you feel? What do you feel in your body when you think about achieving that goal? When you think about actually making that a difference in your life, and you think about after achieving that goal, what are the ripple effects? How do you think and feel about yourself? How do you react differently with other people? Does achieving that goal open up new doors, new opportunities that you wouldn't have taken if you hadn't achieved this step? How does it really affect how you think and feel about yourself and perhaps how some important people in your life think or feel about you? So we think about the ripple effects of achieving that goal. Now, take a relaxing breath all the way in and then all the way out. And one more relaxing breath all the way in and kind of clear your mind. Just kind of empty your mind for a moment. And now we're going to time travel even farther in the future. You're now in the rocking chair stage of your life. It's hard for you to move under your own power. The food you now have is bland, it's soft, it's mushy. You don't want to eat very much to upset your digestive tract, probably sitting in a rocking chair with a blanket over your lap. And as you look back on your life in this chair, you reflect on the big goal that you thought about a moment ago. And you reflect back on this big goal that was never attempted. A part of you said, well, I didn't do it because I didn't have the courage. Or the timing was never right. Or the support, the conditions were never just right enough to take action. And now it's too late. It's never going to happen. That opportunity and all the things that followed from taking that opportunity is gone forever. And now think about what you feel. How intense is that feeling of regret or whatever the emotion is, remorse or sadness? Think about how intense that is. Now, clear your mind again. Take another relaxing breath because I don't want you lingering around in that territory very long. Take a relaxing breath. Clear your mind. And come back to the present. Now, we're going to do a really fast, quick comparison, a really quick survey of the two situations to evaluate which scenario was more intense. But we can only, technology only allows us to survey one part of this question. So do this. If you thought that the expression of regret was stronger, is that right, Ellen? If you think the expression of achieving your goal was the stronger of the two emotions, if you think, when you look now reflecting back on those two scenarios, if achieving the goal was the stronger, the more intense of the two scenarios, push
star 2 on your phone. Or if you're online, then just type in the word me.
And it will give us a quick survey of the difference between, of intensity between these two fantasies, these two imaginations. Push star 2 if
the success of reaching the goal was stronger than your regret in not reaching it.
Or on your computer.
Push the me.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll wait 10 more seconds.
And Ellen is doing a very rapid, and again, we had over 800 people signing up for this. So this topic is so crucial in our field. It's unbelievably how important it is.
So, Michelle, how many me's do you think you have about?
I have about maybe 10.
Okay. So it looks like basically about one-fourth of the people, compared to adding mine on the phone with Michelle's, about one-fourth found it's stronger the success side, and three-fourths found
the regret stronger. Now, here's what's interesting, and it has a lot to do with how you work with couples and or how you work with yourself. The tendency to be more sensitive to possible losses than to possible gains is one of the best supported findings in social science. Again, I'll repeat that. The tendency to be more sensitive to possible losses than to possible gains is one of the best supported findings in social science, emphasizing what your couple or individual client may lose if they do not pursue goals that are important to them, is a very viable and important way of looking at instilling, creating, and increasing motivation to go forward.
In fact, we sent out a survey about motivation about a couple months ago, and we had 300 therapists who answered the questions that we sent out. And the first question, one of the questions was, how big of a problem do you consider the issue of motivation to be in couples therapy? And what was really interesting about that one is that out of the 304 people who responded to the survey, only 5 said that motivation was a small problem. And in fact, 75% of the group who responded said that it was a large or very large problem. So I think that all of us all around the world who are seeing couples are definitely seeing motivation as a significant issue. And the second, one of the other questions we asked, which we'll even talk more about later, but is what techniques or interventions have you found most helpful to improve couples' motivation? And there were two interesting things about this. One is that there was such a scattering of different techniques put out that I think it kind of indicated to me that many of us are struggling to figure out what are the best ways to increase motivation or inspire more motivation. But also the one answer that was put 16 times, and that was the highest of any single intervention, was exactly what Pete was just talking about, visualizing the ugly future if nothing changes and taking couples through that fantasy of what happens if nothing is different. So
now here's just a quick aside. If you want to increase motivation, it's doing both. Have them fantasize the ugly future and go into detail about what the benefits and the ripple effects would be for achieving and moving in the direction of creating and achieving that goal. So it's really the best of both worlds, the ugly future and what are the benefits, how you're going to gain.
And so what Pete and I have really been interested in is looking deeper into the question of motivation, especially in couples therapy. Because in couples therapy, you have two people. You're not just talking about motivating one person, but you're looking at the interplay. And when we first started talking about motivation quite a few years ago, we had divided it into 3 types of motivation and encouraged therapists to look with each partner at where they fit. So we talked about partners who were truly motivated, those who would do homework and set goals and really follow through. And we talked about the unmotivated person, who was the person who dug in and really maybe didn't want to be there and wasn't going to do much in the way of follow through. And then we defined a third type, which was what we called the motivated, unmotivated person. And that was the person who would express a high degree of motivation, but actually their motivation came primarily out of a desire to change the partner, and their desire to change themselves was low. And so that was a beginning way of looking at motivation. And now we're taking it and refining it a lot more on specific issues. And many of you have been following the video series that we sent out. And if some of you have not been following that, you can access it actually from the same page in which you access this call. And you can go back later and watch some of the videos. But on the first video, we define motivation as the urge or inspiration that moves or prompts a person to take action. And specifically, we're looking at what is it that will ignite the urge for particular clients to come out from behind the emotional self-protective bubble that they hide out in order to feel safe, and what is it that will enable them to become more active. And in couples, there's usually often low motivation to comply with a partner's wishes, especially in highly distressed couples, because frequently one partner desperately wants a change that the other has no urge to do. And of course, a common example of that is sexual desire discrepancy, but there's also many other examples in areas of division of roles and responsibilities, the quality and quantity of sex or affection, how kids are disciplined, particularly maybe on spending money. And so there's that intricate interplay between who wants what and why, and even whether you, their therapist, agrees that what a partner wants will actually lead to significant changes in the relationship. And that's especially true if you think about the number of people who want mind reading and want their partners to be able to know what they want and deliver it without them having to speak up. So we've now expanded our way of looking at motivation into four components. And the four components are, the first one is desire. This has to do with how high or how much does a person desire the change that they're requesting or wanting. Second is the likelihood of success. And this has to do with whether a person believes that success is possible. Now, a good example for me would be I'm a tennis player. I have a really, really high desire to play at Wimbledon. However, I do not believe that success is going to happen in my lifetime. I started way too late. The third one is unwanted effort. And this has to do with the effort that's actually going to be needed to make the change. And is the effort embraced? Does somebody have some enthusiasm and some positive energy around it? Or is there mainly a lot of foot dragging and desire to avoid the effort? And fourth is the emotional risk. In other words, how much emotional challenge does someone experience at the thought of taking the risk or taking action? I'm going to give you now two clinical examples to make this a lot clearer. In the first case, I'm meeting with a couple, and the session begins with the husband wanting his wife to have dinner with him at 7 o'clock at night when he gets home from work. He complained a lot that she would never eat dinner with him. I decided to try out this equation on them and see where they were on these components. So for him, the desire for her to eat dinner with him was a 9. His likelihood of success for him was, he said, it's a 9 because I'm going to show up. I'll be there. I'll be waiting for her. And I believe we can make this work. For him, there was no unwanted effort because she was the one making dinner. He could relax. He wanted to sit in bed together and watch television. And the emotional risk for him was very minimal. So if you just look at his side of the equation, it looks very, very easy. And you kind of wonder why his wife does not want to do this. But then when I asked her, she said her desire was very low. First of all, she did not want to have dinner in bed in front of the television. She objected to both eating together, watching television, but also especially eating in bed. Her likelihood of success, she said, was a 2. She says, I might do it occasionally, but I feel claustrophobic if I'm in bed with him. And it turned out that she had had multiple surgeries in childhood, and that she had been confined to bed and had to listen to her parents fighting whenever she was in bed and stuck there. The unwanted effort for her was very high because she had to make dinner and then eat it, which she and eat it in a place where she hated to be. And the emotional risk for her was also very, very high because she actually had some fears of having a panic attack if she felt like she was stuck in bed too long. So if you look at the combination of the two of them, they will have very little chance of success unless they can find a way to work on it more as a team and figure it out more together.
But see, actually walking each person through those components of motivation, it gives each of them a more structured way of looking at what is wanted and what is not wanted and why.
And so as I began to break it down with them, you know, I asked him what's most important to him, being together, having the meal, being in bed, watching television, and when he listened to her, was he clear that he had to be actively involved in creating the solution? And that's one of the principles that Pete and I apply, which is that the person who has the much higher desire for the behavior to change has to be very actively involved in creating the conditions and the solution. They also have to learn how to be sensitive to the emotional risk that their partner is taking. And in order to do that, if they're able to do that, they will be able to work as a team to create the viable alternatives. Now, a second example actually took place in an individual session that I had with a client who I have also been working with them as a couple. And this is actually a 27-year-long marriage, but in this relationship, it's been a very symbiotic relationship. And the wife had been wanting more freedom, more time apart. She was feeling suffocated by the amount of togetherness that her husband wanted. And finally, he had actually agreed to go on a vacation with some guy friends. And so he was gone on this vacation when I was seeing her alone. And so I said to her, when he comes back, do you think it would make sense to greet him warmly and thank him for taking the risk of going off on this vacation by himself when he's so afraid that if the two of you take separate vacations, it's just going to be the beginning of the end as you two drift farther and farther apart? And her response to me was, well, I'm just not that kind of a person. And I said, what kind of a person is that? And she said, mushy, gushing. And so I'd asked her actually to humor me and run through the four components, again, of the motivation process on the issue of the desire to have more freedom and not so much pressure for togetherness. And so I asked her about how high was her desire for that freedom so that she could go on vacation separately at times and so could he, or she could have more time with her individual women friends. And she said her desire for it was an 8 or a 9, so really, really high. And we asked people to rate all of these on a 1 to 10 scale. I then said, what do you think is the likelihood of success if you don't support any of your husband's risk-taking in this way? And she said, well, I guess it's a 2 if I don't give him any support. And I said, well, how much effort would it take for you to be a little mushy-gushy, to give him some positive encouragement when he comes home? And she said, actually, it's very high. I'm not comfortable being gushy. And she also said that the emotional risk for her felt high as well, because it would mean that she was a different kind of a person. It would mean that she was different than she had been scripted to be by her mother. And so I said, so what does this tell you about the outcome that's likely for the two of you? And she said, well, it tells me that I'm not very likely to get what I want if I'm not willing to put out some effort, even though it's going to be uncomfortable. And so at first I stroked her for her recognition that she was not going to get the kind of outcome she wanted.
That's actually a good sign of somebody in the early stages of differentiation, being able to recognize their part, their partner, what each contributes or doesn't contribute.
And so then we spend some time going through, okay, you know you want that outcome, so what is going to motivate you to go through that much emotional discomfort? And we spend probably the good part of 45 minutes really teasing that out. And at the end of the discussion, she'd come up with four things. One is that they would actually provide a better role model for their daughter, or a role model of a marriage that she thought was a better role model. The outcome also would be that she would get to have more fun with her friends and not always have to do everything together as a couple. Another one was that she would get a break from housework by going out and spending time with her friends, going on vacation separately alone. But the one that was most sort of, I don't know what the right best word is, because it had some positives and some negatives for her, but it was that she could see a path where she could end up not being like her mother. That, I mean, her mother had scripted her not to be mushy-gushy, but her mother had scripted her not to like men. And she could see that this was a step out of that position of being scripted to hate men or put men down. And it would be uncomfortable, it was going to create some anxiety, but that it was, in fact, a role that she wanted to have that was different than what she had grown up with. So in the second example, another principle involved is that the higher desire partner needs to give acknowledgement and appreciation for the effort that is involved, and that it's really essential to explore more deeply both why the desire is valued so highly and also what it is going to take. What are the risks that's going to be involved in making that change?
Yeah, the notion of why something is desired, the values, the interests, the concerns behind it, to spend more time exploring the nuances and distinctions of that is really crucial, because it's a way of increasing motivation at different levels. Now, you can take these four components about desire, likelihood of success, unwanted effort, and emotional risk, and you can apply it to not just your couples, but your own relationship. Here's a quick example of how this equation played out in a situation between Ellen and me. Now, I like visiting battlefields, but Ellen's not so keen about it, and maybe it has something to do with, you know, in the Vietnam War, she joined the anti-war movement, moved to California to be with Joan Baez to resist draft, et cetera, et cetera. But here's how it played out. So I would say to Ellen, I would like to go back to visit World War I battlefields in Europe, especially the Battle of the Somme. So, Ellen, what's your level of desire to visit that battlefield?
About a zero.
Now,
the reason for that, in fact, is that I've already visited some World War I battlefields with you and spent many long days doing that.
No, I don't think it's many long days.
It's a lot of days. It just felt like that to you.
So your level of desire is pretty puny. So with your current perspective, what's the likelihood of success in me getting you to go with me? Because I really would like you to go with me instead of doing it alone, which I have done, and I actually prefer doing this together.
It's pretty, maybe a two.
Okay. So then we go to the next one. So, Ellen, how much unwanted effort is there, in fact, to visit the Somme battlefields?
Well, the unwanted effort has two parts, Pete, actually. One part is I know that I'm the one who usually does all the trip planning, and so it's hard for me to imagine doing all the trip planning on this when it's somewhere I don't even want to go and something I really don't want to do. And it's also hard because once we get there, you are off in another world, and I basically feel like I spend a couple days alone.
Okay. What about the emotional risk component?
There's not a lot of emotional risk for me. I mean, it's not that. But let's go back, Pete, and talk a little more about why this is so important to you.
Well, actually, it's kind of interesting because there's especially something compelling about the battlefields of World War I, in which the guys would get out of their trench, cross no man's land under heavy artillery fire, encounter yard after yard after yard deep of coiled barbed wire into machine guns and rifle fire. And the courage it would take to do that inspires the heck out of me for the part of me that says, what am I whining about in my life? Jeez, look what they did. Why do my knees buckle when I try to tackle this endeavor, this project in my life? Look at what these guys were able to do. So it's actually very inspiring to me on those different levels.
And I do appreciate that it's inspiring to you. I'm not sure I'm clear why it's important that I do it with you.
Well, actually, if you do it with me, it goes to, you're right about, sometimes I get caught up in my own world as we tour the battlefields. But having you there while I do this creates an association with me that we could do things together. And if I was more transparent about what I was thinking or feeling as we went and as we went through the battlefields and how that could apply to my life and the goals that I have set, the goals that I want to achieve, and be more transparent and open with you, would that make a difference?
Yeah, that'd make a big difference. You mean you really wouldn't space out?
No, I call it focusing, and you call it spacing out. But how about this? If I was a lot more transparent about the meaning for you, share with you, and also if I made the plan so you didn't have to do any of the heavy lifting to make the plans after we found convenient dates, would that help?
That would help a lot.
And how about one more thing? After we do the battlefield or even before, if we could visit some other place in Europe that would be of high interest to you, that I would support, encourage, and do with a good nature, would that make a difference?
Yes, it definitely would.
So if we put this all together.
How about we go to the Impressionist Museum in Paris?
All right. Now that could be okay. Do we have to spend days there?
No, but we could spend at least a few hours.
That's okay. That's cool. And I would do it with a great attitude. So that's one way that you can start looking at how to apply these components to someplace in your own marriage with your partner. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in the video number 2 that we put up in this series, I walk through some other examples. And I walk through one example where it's really clear that the couple has to work on it together. And in the other example that I talked about, there's an example of the emotional risk being particularly high for the wife and it having to do with some of her own issues in terms of how she's able to stay separate from his emotion of grief, but still be able to be giving and involved and connected to him. And so it made it clear in her case that a lot of the work was individual work to be done with her, some in the presence of him, but it wasn't so much the interaction that was going to take to solve the problem as the individual work.
See, and as you get clearer about why something is important and what the ripple effects will be and why somebody is resistant or reluctant to go along with it, that often uncovers other things in one or the other person's life, trauma, bad experiences, which then allows you to utilize other components, other tools that we have in helping people deal with pain, fear, and trauma. The energy psychology, the neuroscience applications, how to look at their connection through the lens of attachment theory and differentiation. So exposing this actually makes it much more of an easier entree than to intervene because you have a larger context to deal with this. Couples often think or hope that there is some kind of magic resolution or solution to challenges and problems they're having, that this resolution can happen without risk or effort. They hope for that. And these are the couples who have really been entrenched for the longest time. They're really coming in and hoping that you can weave some kind of magic. They'll tell you their stories, and you're going to sort it out and make something really happen. The reality is there are no ideal solutions for any complex problem without trade-offs. This means that one or both people are going to be required to make new efforts, take emotional risks, be more patient, be more understanding, etc. These are the trade-offs that are going to be required to create many of the outcomes that they seek.
And the trade-offs that will enable you to help them build the emotional muscle that actually leads them into the kind of relationship they want to have.
And this is why the motivation problem is so complex, because in any given area, one or both partners have a very defended psychological attitude of, why should I have to be the one who changes in this area? Now, how we approach as therapists this rhetorical question is what makes couples therapy so darn challenging, and why therapists need to be so grounded in leadership, being able to structure instead of just react to their emotional storms, to understand the attachment theory, differentiation theory, and how neuroscience connects all of this, and the skills that are required to intervene with high distress couples are not just about theory, technique, and interventions, because when it feels like you're flying a helicopter in a hurricane, that's when you, the therapist, need the skills to remain centered and not get caught up in their emotional storms. And it's this, what I'm just describing, this is what has driven Ellen and me to help therapists not work so darn hard with high distressed, self-absorbed, conflict-habituated couples. It went even farther. We wanted to find ways to start the therapy before they even sat down for the first meeting with you. Is there a way to increase motivation to help them detach from the notion of you're going to weave magic? Because if they come in with that attitude, unraveling that and helping them work through those wishes are really hard unless you can get started before their first meeting, which dramatically increases their openness to change, which means it affects their motivation to be accountable. It means that they're going to be growing up in your office instead of hoping for rainbows and unicorns and lollipops without risk or effort. Because the reality is creating a real marriage requires transparency, it requires risk, it requires effort. And this is a marriage that's worth fighting for when you put in that effort. So we're going to add a couple more ways how to do that today, increase it, the motivation. And I was just thinking, oh my goodness, if only there was a convenient online training program that could come to you, that could help guide you through your toughest couples. That would be pretty terrific if it happened online. And it would be even better if it was affordable. And what about if you were in an online training program and you could ask, write in questions about your last tough session and then get a reply before the next session, where you could get unstuck and you could stop the emotional and financial cost of premature terminations? But doing this kind of training program would probably take somebody who is dedicated to developing a cadre of therapists around the world, therapists who could support each other and learn from other master therapists. Oh, wait a minute. There might be such a program, but you're going to have to wait a few more minutes to hear about it. And at the very end, you're going to learn about an exercise that keeps the responsibility for growth on the couple.
Well, hey, Pete, it was nice of you to mention my training program. I didn't know you were going to do that right there. But anyway, I love the online training. But I want to go back now and talk a little more about the results of the survey that we did. Because when I read read through every single response that we got, and like I said, we had 304 people who responded. And one of the other questions was, how frequently do you see partners who present themselves as motivated but don't follow through on homework and insights? So these, what we were asking about is what we used to call the motivated, unmotivated partner. And I was trying to get at, you know, is this, when couples come in, is this the kind of person that people are seeing most frequently? And in fact, 74% of the therapists who answered, or 226 therapists, said that this was often a component of the couple's therapy that they did. And only 3% said that they rarely had this issue. So again, if we look worldwide, we can see that when you get two people in the interdependency of a marriage and with one or the other pushing hard for a change, you're going to get people hiding out in those emotional bubbles and being very resistant to the change that's being requested. And that's where so much of the pain comes from in the couples that we see. And then, as I mentioned before, we asked therapists about the techniques or interventions that they found to be most helpful to improving motivation, not to improving the relationship, but to improving the couple's motivation to work in therapy. And again, what was interesting to me is quite a few people answered and said, I really haven't found anything that's greatly useful. And then there was a huge scattering. There were 68 different interventions listed overall. But on the page for this call, you'll see the chart that I've put up of the 9 most commonly mentioned things that therapists find helpful. And the fact that the one that was the most helpful was visualizing the ugly future, but that still only had 16 responses. Next was, and if when you're looking at the chart, you don't have to look at it now, but it's posted there for you afterwards. It's going around the circle clockwise, and the colors represent the percentage of that total circle. So you have 13 people who said that giving very small incremental homework assignments was what they found helpful. 10 who said that goal setting that was coupled with really careful monitoring and review, that they didn't just set the goal and then leave. 10 others talked about using motivational interviewing. 8 liked visualizing the big why. In other words, helping the couple get in touch with why they would make the effort, why they want to change, and doing that in terms of imagery or visualization.
I just want to underline that for a moment. Understanding the why is what ultimately drives our motivation. And it's often said, and I believe this to a large degree, when we lose our why, we lose our way.
Next were 6 people who mentioned that they like to interplay some individual sessions with the couple sessions and that they were more able to incite some motivation to take action in the individual sessions when the partner wasn't present. 4 liked using scales to rate the level of motivation. 4 said that discussing the resistance directly was most helpful. And 4 liked using metaphors. There was also an assortment of other responses like active listening, using communication exercises like the initiator-inquirer, exploring childhood wounds, etc. But overall, that was what we found in the survey. And now I'd like to skip ahead to an intervention that I've been using recently to disrupt the negative confirmation bias. And what negative confirmation bias is, that is we look for evidence that supports our negative judgments and to exclude or minimize evidence to the contrary. So the longer two people are together, the more they're likely to hold negative beliefs, negative judgments, and that those negative beliefs and judgments actually serve to help them keep the likelihood of success very low, and they won't want to put in the effort to make a difference. So here's a new exercise that I've developed in the last few months and that I find pretty exciting and really working quite well. And here's how it goes. I say, and I don't do this in the first or second session, but I do it with couples after I've gotten to know them a bit and see where they're stuck. And so I'll call the husband in this case, Sam, and I say to him, Sam, I'd like to bring 2 chairs into the room. And in chair number 1, this is the chair where you see your wife's behaviors and you judge them as negative. You don't believe she wants to change in this particular area. You don't believe she has a vision of a better future. And you don't think she wants to do things with you. So this is the chair where you are absolutely convinced in all the negative traits that you've told me over the last few weeks. And here's chair number 2. And this is the chair where we're going to do our work today. And chair number two is the chair where you're confused. She just did something that you judge in a negative way. However, I am making this chair into a detective. In this chair, you're only allowed to ask her questions that ferret out what her positive intent was behind the negative behavior. So I want you to work really, really hard to see if you can discover something positive that she wished for in what she did. And so then I coach the client into asking lots of questions that they would never ask or think of asking. And when they start to flip into the negative judgment, I say, let's put that back over in the other chair. That part is present most of the time. This chair number two is not very accessible to you and not very often present in your marriage. So I want to see if we can build up chair number two. And so then, in this case with Sam, I walked him through an incident where she had yelled at him after Christmas, and he was very sensitive to her anger and wasn't able to see at all that behind it was her stress, her exhaustion. She'd had two dinner parties for 30 people, and she'd done all of the work, and she really wanted him to thank her, support her, and not put more stress on her at that moment. And actually, she was trying to rely on him for some emotional support, which was something that he had wanted for a long time. And so it's your coaching and you're walking them through that starts to help them develop an inquiring mind, a detective mind, and more curiosity to look for positive motivation underneath a negative behavior.
All right, just a couple of loose ends. When people embark on change, they often are reluctant to because they are afraid to fail. We talk about that, and then I give them this definition of failure, which is it simply means falling short of achieving something attempted or desired. Falling short of achieving something attempted or desired, there's no moral judgment there. It's like, who wants to live a life where you never attempt something important or desired? So it's just part of life. Falling down is not failing. And the other one is when they talk about risk, I often give them there's a lot of definitions of courage, but the definition of courage that I like that I offer couples is courage is deciding that something is more important than our fear. It's deciding something is more important than our fear. I like that definition of courage. And in addition to investigating why goals are important to them, we often don't investigate what's the support system to help somebody reach their objective. And getting support for important goals works better when there's a support system to draw upon, and who you hang out with has a big effect on your success endeavors. For example, if one of your good friends becomes obese, you've got a 57% chance of gaining a lot of extra weight yourself. Hanging out with people who seek success, that will strengthen your motivation and achievement because nobody succeeds alone and nobody fails alone. Pay attention to who you hang out with. Seek out those who support your goals. And it's that reason why Ellen and I did a big experiment recently. We started a very small special mastermind group of therapists. And they all have busy practices, but they wanted to do more, reach more people, have a greater influence than their individual practice. In this group, Ellen and I are integrating clinical skills, marketing skills, and personal growth, helping them to overcome the blocks to greater success. The mastermind group is working hard. They're loving it. But here's the key. They're getting the support, the encouragement, skills, and knowledge from each other. And if Ellen and I were to focus on any one of these therapists individually, one at a time, I'm telling you the progress would be slower and a lot more laborious. This group energy, the feedback, the support, the sharing skills would all be missing. But it gets even worse.
Can I give a quick example really quick?
Yeah.
So the woman that was having trouble with her husband, who wanted her husband to go on vacation, but she had been scripted to not like men, I said to her, where could you get support from other women who actually like men? And she said, well, as a matter of fact, I went to a new book group recently, and I was stunned to hear how much the women there liked their husbands and the positive things they were saying. And so I said, well, do you think that might be a good group of people for you to hang out with some more?
So, and the opportunity cost, if somebody doesn't go ahead, the opportunity cost is high because they would not take advantage of opportunities that show up in their current lives. But in a sense, you don't have to do this mastermind group. You can get it at a fraction of the cost in Ellen's online training program where you can get the support, you get the new skills, you become more centered with tough couples, you integrate new approaches without compromising what you already value and what you do. But here's the thing that so many therapists report from this training group of Ellen's is they learn to keep their focus under fire. And when you learn to keep your focus under fire so that you can stay centered, you can teach that much more easily to couples when they get into their own emotional storms. And then that's when it kind of all fits together into when you combine attachment theory, differentiation theory, neuroscience, etc. It's a way of pulling all this together in a very convenient way. So it's a plug for here is a way for some therapists, and it's limited because Ellen obviously can only take a certain number of people in the training program to give them individual attention. But it's a plug for if a part of you is interested in going down that path in an online training program.
Yeah, and Pete's still going to talk about the success trackers, but
so Ellen, I think we're
talk about success trackers.
Success trackers. I think we're going to make it right under the line, which is one of the things that just aggravated the heck out of me was couples, they wouldn't do their homework, they wouldn't listen to each other, and they wouldn't listen to me in the sessions, and then they say, well, are we getting anywhere? And so after just gnashing my teeth, there's got to be a better way. So there's a form that I hand out to couples. It's called Success Trackers, Doing the Daily Double. And I said, here's the thing, that it's like a domino effect. If you guys do a little domino at the beginning, it starts a whole chain reaction. And it starts with you guys becoming more appreciative, kinder, and nicer to each other on a daily basis. And I give them the handout called Success Trackers. And every day, I say, I want you to do two of these things on the list that expresses appreciation, gratitude, do something nice, do something kind for your partner, and avoid some of the things that are on the list that are negative. So, here's what I say to them. I want you to do this for 30 days in a row. And you can do it even if your partner does it. So don't come in here telling me that, well, you're justified in not doing it because your partner didn't do their part. No, you can do your part. And I want you to do this for 30 days in a row. If you do it 22 days in a row and skip a day, you got to start all over again until you get it in 30 days in a row. If you do that and do that one thing, you will begin to notice a difference in your relationship after 30 days. I guarantee it, or you get your misery back. But do it for 30 consecutive days because it will help retrain your brain to get out of that negative confirmation bias and seeing your partner as an opponent, an enemy, the opposition. And it literally starts to rewire your brain, and you will be thinking about yourselves as more of a team working together to create something better for your life. And maybe after doing this and our work in here, maybe you can start to realize the promise of why you guys first got together at the beginning. And so I said earlier that a couple weeks ago when a woman said she couldn't even stand being in the same room with her husband, we talked about success trackers, talked about why it was important, talked about the importance of doing it, and I said, are you committed to do it? And they said, yes. And I said, all right, here's the deal. If you don't do it, the next time you come in, you forfeit the right to complain about your partner. That's how important this is. So they did it. She came in and she said, guess what? It actually started to turn around my negative view of life. She said, I'm pretty pessimistic. I'm the person who says the glass is half empty. But it starts to force me to see things that my partner, my husband, was doing that, in fact, I was overlooking before and convinced that he wasn't hauling his weight. But it turns out he does more than I was appreciative of. So that's just one example of how you can use the success trackers. But you track it, and the first thing they come in, instead of saying, so how was it? And they say, we had a whopper of a fight. You say, wait a minute, let's go back and take a look at the success trackers at that list. Were you guys, did you guys do your homework? All right. That is success. And don't let them minimize that, because too often high distress couples will say, yeah, we did X, but we still had these big fights, like, and they just keep overlooking the positives and the progress they're making. It's a way of keeping them on track about progress they are making. Phew. Okay, Ellen.
Okay, so we are at the ending time for the main part of this call. At the ending time for the main part of this call. At the ending time for the main